Welcome to A Katra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Katra AI. Welcome back for another deep dive. Today we're getting into a really significant work of modern Arabic literature. It's Tayyib Salih's Season of Migration to the North.
Or Masim al-Hijra ila al-Shamal in Arabic.
Exactly. Salih himself was a Sudanese, a major figure, and his own move north to London for studies and work well, it deeply influenced his writing.
Massively. And this novel from 1966 translated just a few years later in 69. It wasn't just impactful, it was declared the most important Arabic novel of the 20th century. Quite the statement.
It really is. So today we're going to explore these intense psychological and cultural clashes that kind of define that post-colonial experience. It's this complex relationship between tradition and modernity that honestly still feels very relevant.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it was groundbreaking back then. Caused quite a stir. It was controversial, definitely, but also hugely acclaimed.
Why the controversy?
Well, mainly its frankness about sexuality, which was, you know, quite something for the time. And also its sharp critique, not just of European colonialism, but also of patriarchal traditions within Arab society itself.
Right. It wasn't just pointing fingers outwards.
Not at all. It's seen as a cornerstone of post-colonial lit and often read, quite powerfully, I think, as a sort of counter-narrative to Conrad's Heart of Darkness.
Ah, that's a fascinating angle. So instead of the European going into Africa?
Exactly. Salih flips it. He sends his protagonist into the supposed heart of London, reversing that colonial gaze. It makes you question, you know, who's civilized, who's the savage. It really pulls apart those neat categories.
That reversal sounds incredibly powerful. It really sets the stage. So for you listening, get ready. This isn't just a simple story. It works like a psychological mystery, maybe a political allegory too.
And definitely a deep meditation on identity, alienation, and the stories we tell ourselves, really, just to get by.
It's an intense journey, no doubt, but really worth it. Okay, so where does the story begin?
Right, so it starts with our narrator. We actually never learn his name. He's just come back to his village, Wad Hamid, right there on the Nile in Sudan.
After studying abroad?
Yep, 7 years in England, doing his doctorate. And he comes back with this deep longing for what he sees as the simplicity, the authenticity of his village life.
He feels he can bridge the two worlds.
He really does. He thinks he's this sort of unique connection point, you know?
Yeah.
Seen the North, come back unchanged, ready for a quiet, purposeful life. That ideal homecoming scenario.
Yeah, that dream of returning, enriched but somehow untouched. It sounds almost too perfect.
Well, Salih doesn't let that illusion last long. Almost immediately, this other figure arrives. Mysterious, charismatic newcomer named Mustafa Sayyid.
Ah, here we go. Disruption.
Exactly. And the big question driving things early on is, who is this guy? What's his story? What secrets is he hiding?
And how does the narrator first get a sense that something's off?
It's this really unsettling moment. They're having a late-night drinking session, pretty casual, and suddenly Mustafa just flawlessly recites this romantic English poem.
Out of nowhere, in the Sudanese village setting.
Completely out of place. It deeply unnerves the narrator. And that's the spark, really. It ignites this obsessive quest in the narrator to figure out who Mustafa Sayyid really is.
It sounds like Mustafa represents something the narrator hasn't confronted.
Precisely. He becomes this kind of dark double, a doppelganger, a man whose journey north wasn't like the narrator's quiet studies. No, Mustafa's was about violent conquest, emotional wreckage, real tragedy.
A stark contrast.
Absolutely. And it immediately throws up that fundamental question. Can you ever truly go home again once another culture has fundamentally changed you?
That question really hangs over everything, doesn't it? So let's dig into Mustafa's past then. What was his journey north actually like?
Well, Mustafa's backstory is... It's haunting. He was incredibly intelligent as a child, just brilliant. Plucked from his village, ends up becoming a top economist in London.
So a success story on the surface.
On the surface, yes. But here's the crucial part. He didn't go there as a humble student eager to learn. He saw himself as a conqueror. He carried this deep, simmering rage against the colonial North.
A conqueror? How did he mean that?
He says it himself, quite chillingly. I have come to you as a conqueror. A virus that has entered the bloodstream of Europe.
Wow, that's intense. A virus. So how did he act on that? How did this conquest play out?
Not through economics, not directly. He channeled that rage, that feeling of being a virus, into these very destructive sexual conquests.
Right. He seduces several English women.
Yes, women like Anne Hammond, Sheila Greenwood, Isabella Seymour. And he does it by playing a role, the role he thinks they want, the exotic Arab Othello.
Using their own fantasies, their own Orientalist stereotypes against them.
Exactly. He saw these affairs as a form of reverse colonization, a conquest using his mind, his body, exploiting their desires. It was a cold, calculated act of revenge.
Utterly devastating. And these relationships, inevitably, they end tragically.
They do. It all kind of builds towards his marriage to Jean Morris. She's described as being as fiercely independent and maybe as destructive as he was.
A volatile mix.
A real battle of wills.
Mm-mm.
And it ends horrifically. One night, he murders her in their bed.
My goodness. And the consequences. He's caught, obviously.
He is. And in court, he says something incredibly revealing. He says, I am no Othello. Othello was a lie. I am a lie.
I am a lie. That's profound self-awareness, but also terrifyingly empty.
It really is the core of it. That quote captures the chilling irony. He knows his victory, his revenge. It was hollow. It destroyed others, yes, but it also destroyed him.
Turned him into the very thing he was fighting against, in a way.
He became a hollow man, like he says, a germ, a lie. This is Salih showing us the deep psychological scars of colonialism. It's not just political, it's a kind of psychological virus.
And it can twist the victim into becoming a perpetrator.
That's the devastating insight here. How historical trauma can erupt into personal violence, the brutal cycle.
And the story doesn't end with Mustafa's trial, does it? His influence lingers.
It absolutely does. After confessing all this to the narrator, Mustafa later disappears during a Nile flood. It's ambiguous accident, suicide, we don't know for sure.
But he leaves something behind.
He does. He makes the narrator the legal guardian of his wife, Hosna bint Mahmud, and their two young sons. He basically burdens the narrator with his secrets, his entire legacy.
So the narrator is trapped.
Completely trapped. Haunted by Mustafa's life, seeing these disturbing echoes in his own experience, it's a heavy weight he never asked for.
Let's talk about Hosna. She isn't just a victim or a passive figure, is she?
Not at all. She's depicted as really powerful, resilient, proud. She represents, in many ways, the unyielding spirit of the village. Very determined to raise her sons, protect her independence after Mustafa's gone.
But that independence creates conflict within the village itself.
Ironically, yes. There's this unpleasant older man, Wat Reis, who becomes obsessed with marrying her. He's described as an old lecher.
And the village elders.
They side with him. They start pressuring Hosna relentlessly to marry Wat Reis.
So Wat Reis represents more than just one unpleasant man.
Oh, definitely. He becomes a symbol of the corruption within tradition, this stagnant predatory side of it, patriarchal entitlement that sees women basically as property.
And this is crucial, right? Saul is showing that oppression isn't just imported from the colonial north.
Exactly. It can thrive just as strongly from within the traditions of the village itself. It's a really sharp critique.
What about the narrator? He's her guardian, technically. Does he try to help?
He does try, but his attempts are described as weak, hesitant, sort of modern, but ultimately ineffective against the weight of village tradition and pressure. He can't really protect her autonomy.
Which leads to another tragedy.
Yes. A horrifying one. Hosna is forced into the marriage with Wat Reis on their wedding night.
Yeah.
In a final devastating act of defiance, she kills him.
And then
she takes her own life.
Oh, that's brutal. How does this affect the narrator?
It completely shatters him. It jolts him out of his passivity, his sort of intellectual distance. He's forced to see that the tranquil village he idealized, it contains a violence just as savage, just as destructive as anything Mustafa did or experienced in London.
The idealized image of home is destroyed.
Utterly. He realizes the violence isn't just out there in the north, it's right here too. This realization pushes him over the edge.
What does he do?
He feels compelled, almost drawn, to finally confront Mustafa's secrets directly. He breaks into that secret lock study Mustafa had.
The one no one was supposed to enter. And what does he find?
It's a tourist shock. It's not a Sudanese room at all. It's a perfect replica of an English library. English books everywhere, fireplace, and photographs.
Photographs.
Photographs of Mustafa's victims, the English women he seduced. It's like a shrine to his life of lies, his conquests. Cold, alien, right there in the heart of the village.
The symbolism is overwhelming. That room represents Mustafa's completely split self, right?
Perfectly. That bifurcated consciousness. And standing there, the narrator feels like he's merging with Mustafa, like Mustafa's ghost is about to consume him.
Mm.
It's the peak of his psychological crisis.
He has to escape that room, that feeling.
He does. He runs out completely overwhelmed and heads straight for the Nile. the same river that might have taken Mustafa.
And he throws himself in. He
throws himself into the current. He feels the water pulling him under, catching him right between the north and south banks.
The Nile itself, it's such a powerful symbol throughout the novel.
It's probably the most dominant symbol. It's life, time, history flowing, but also destruction, death. For the narrator at this moment, it's the ultimate test. Life or death, north or south.
That fractured identity caught between two poles.
Exactly. The post-colonial subject, literally drowning between two worlds. His will starts to fade. He feels himself letting go.
But he doesn't fully give in.
No. In those last desperate moments, he makes a conscious choice. He screams out, "Help! Help!"
That final cry, what does it signify?
It's huge. It's a rejection, isn't it? A rejection of both those destructive paths, Mustafa's nihilistic revenge and lies, and the oppressive, deadly traditions of the village represented by Wad Rea's and Hasna's fate.
So it's an affirmation.
Yes, an affirmation of life, a plea for connection, maybe for community. It's a choice to live, to struggle, even if there are no easy answers. It's this moment of raw, desperate hope, choosing life, even in the face of everything.
So looking back at the whole novel, Season of Migration, what are the main takeaways? You've mentioned the psychological scars of colonialism, that virus's idea.
Definitely that. And the fractured identity of someone caught between cultures.
Right.
Also a really strong critique of those easy East-West binaries showing that, you know, corruption, humanity, violence, it's everywhere.
Not just in one place or the other. And that complex link between sexuality, power, and revenge that runs through Mustafa's story.
Right. And it challenges both modernity and tradition. It doesn't give easy answers, saying one is good and the other bad. It shows the failures and corruptions in both.
It leaves you with a lot to think about, not neat resolutions.
Absolutely not. There's this profound ambiguity, a real sense of sorrow at the end. It refuses easy moral judgments. You can't just blame colonialism entirely, nor can you romanticize tradition.
It forces you away from simplistic narrative.
Precisely. Colonial guilt, native innocence, it blows those simple ideas apart. And it leaves you with those really big, haunting questions. How do you build a future from a past that's so broken? How do you find a whole self in a world that feels fragmented?
And those questions are why it still feels so relevant, I think. Why it's seen as such a foundational text.
It really is a masterpiece, and its power hasn't faded at all.
Ultimately, maybe Saleh's work tells us that finding wholeness isn't about going back to some imagined perfect past.
No, it seems to demand something else. A courageous choice to affirm life right now, with all its messy contradictions.
A powerful thought to end on. How do we affirm life amidst our own world's contradictions?
Makes you wonder what help we might be crying out for.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Apatra Foundation.